This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to an ever-expanding bookshelf. I'm Kate Evans, and you usually hear me with Cassie McCullough as we review new fiction every week. But I also love talking to writers, not just about their work, their creativity, their juggling with words, but also about the books they recommend, those they return to, and especially those that sit next to their latest work. Today, Australian writer Tilly Lawless, writing and reading bodies, and English novelist John McGregor with a book that takes us into the impossible landscapes of both aphasia and Antarctica in his Lean, Fall, Stand. But we'll begin in Australia. Tilly Lawless is a writer who also works in the sex industry and uses that experience in her fiction. Her debut novel is Nothing But My Body. Tilly Lawless, hello, and thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, your novel is called Nothing But My Body, and it's Maddie's story. So who is she? Introduce us to her.
Yeah, well, I mean, technically, it isn't Maddie's story. Like, Maddie's her working name, and I deliberately left the narrator nameless because I wanted the reader to feel, like, completely immersed in it and feel as if they were her in her thoughts, and I thought if I put a name in that would like disrupt that. But I think I might have made a kind of technical error with that, because people say because she doesn't have a name they just assume it's me. But it was intended to make the author feel like they were in her head. But she's a queer sex worker in her 20s in Sydney, and yeah.
Well, let's talk more about that. I mean, that the presumption that it is you. I mean, this is a novel. It's called a novel. But I understand from both your author bio and from reading various interviews with you that there are some parallels. So how do you define what you're doing with this novel? I mean, do you call it a novel?
Yeah, no, it's definitely a novel, because for me, I set out to write fiction. I mean, it's such an interesting delineation between fiction and nonfiction, obviously, because so much of fiction is influenced by the person's life who wrote it anyway. But for me, because not all of it is true, it immediately falls into fiction. And even the things that are true, I change sequence of events to create a narrative structure. And I went into it with a very intentional and strict structure with the days. And To me, it's semi-autobiographical, but it's definitely not a non-fiction. And I actually found out recently, I think also the reason people struggle so much with as to how much of it is me is because parts of it are taken from my Instagram, which is like I've used as like an online diary for years and years. And I basically used like Instagram diary entries as like a jumping off point for the start of each chapter. And so I actually found out recently that Helen Garner did the same in her book Monkey Grip, that she started with diary entries that she'd written from her real life and then extracted from them a narrative that she could create. And I feel like that's very much what I've done.
So this book takes place over just 8 days.
Yeah, 8 days, but not consecutive days, like 8 days scattered across a period of time. And the structure of like having sort of a day in someone's mind, I took from Virginia Woolf's Mrs. Dalloway, because I really liked the way that the character in that was going around, like getting ready for this dinner party. And as she would like look at a vase or something, she would like think back to other parts of her life. And that was the structure I wanted to mimic.
This is also a story of partly a story of a workplace and a woman's working life. And in the very first day, we meet her in her workplace. So what is it that she's doing, and how important is that to her identity?
Yeah, so she's a sex worker, and she works across massage, full service massage parlors and brothels and private escorting through the novel. Look, I feel like if you're someone who's done sex work, it's a job that's so stigmatized, and it really shifts your entire outlook on the world. And so I think everything she writes is very much through the lens of a sex worker and someone who's done sex work for like a fairly long time. But I didn't want sex work to be the focus and obsession of the book. Like, for me, I wanted it to be about mental health and queer community and infatuation and stuff like that. So I took inspiration from this, actually, from this book called City of Night, written by this Mexican-American gay man, John Reschy, in the 1960s. And he was also a sex worker, a gay male sex worker. And he wrote this book about queer community in LA and New York and San Fran at the time. And I really liked the way he made sex work kind of just the backdrop of the story and not the problem topic. And so I wanted to do the same thing.
But you also mentioned obsession, and this character is dealing with a relationship that is a very fraught relationship. Tell us more about that, writing about relationships and obsession and a difficult relationship.
Yeah, so that for me was really cathartic. A lot of the relationship with stuff was drawn directly from my life, in that I've had a really... I have a personally a fraught relationship with romantic relationships, in that I'm not sure if it's something that I even aspire to anymore or even think there's any sense in anymore. I think often they bring more hurt than joy. And so I think a lot of the novel was me processing my own sort of coming to terms with rejecting romantic love and being like, you know what, if I'm single for the rest of my life, that's okay.
Well, there was a very telling sigh in your reaction to my question there. But given that we're framing this whole conversation in terms of books and reading and other books that have shaped you, are there other books that you have read that reflect that view of relationships that you want to explore?
Actually, not really. I'm really into romantic books. Like, I love pastoral romances, like Lorna Doone by R.D. Blackmore is one of my favourite books.
What do you love about it?
Oh, I love that the complicated thing in their relationship is the external factors around them. Like, it's difficult for them to be together because she lives in the Doone Valley, you know, but actually they really love each other. There's never any, in those kind of pastoral romances, I feel like all the issues are never issues between the two characters in love. It's like things around them that have to get sorted out, and once they're sorted out, everything's happy. So, like, I really like those stories. So I think I often read as escapism.
But I interrupted. You started to say there are a whole lot of types of romances that you really enjoy reading. So what are some others? I think pastoral romances.
Yeah, pastoral romances I love. I also love historical fiction with a bit of romance. So I love all, for example, Alexander Dumas novels like Count of Monte Cristo and Three Musketeers. And I really love Robert Louis Stevenson's novels like Kidnapped, and especially the sequel to that has a romance in it. I think I like when there's like a lot of hullabaloo happening around and there's
a lot of action.
There's no emotional conflict.
So what else then, if we were to put this novel of yours on a bookshelf of other books that have influenced it or that you'd like to sort of see sitting next to it or even in opposition to it, but let's start with in concert with it, what else would have to sit on that shelf next to Nothing But My Body?
Yeah, well, definitely, as I said, Virginia Woolf and John Reschy, because it was deliberately inspired by both of those. And I think also it was really important for me in writing it that it had a pace that would work well with being read aloud. So I was also influenced by that in Virginia Woolf's A Room of One's Own, because I went and saw a play at Belvoir last year where it was just a hour and a half monologue of that. I think always when I'm writing, I think of the pace of something being read aloud. Like, it's never just about the words on the page, it's also about the performance of it. So I think the other works that inspired that as well were the way a lot of the beat writers write. So Henry Miller, or when you think of William Burroughs, the pace that they had in their writing was something that I really wanted to evoke, even though I actually hate a lot of their writing moralistically. Like, I do like the rhythm. So they would be there. And then I think another author that would definitely be there would be Juna Barnes, and specifically her book Ladies' Almanac, because I think she's really influenced the way that I write long, like, run-on sentences, kind of like almost like a blurring the boundaries between poetry and prose. Like, I really like the way she does that. And so she would be there as well. And also she's a lesbian author too, so like another queer author. Yeah, I feel like I very much see myself with books that are for, like, as part of like a queer tradition of writing.
But interestingly, almost all of these examples are sort of the first half of the 20th century. So it's almost part of a sort of modernist writing tradition.
Definitely. I mean, I don't know if I could call, I actually don't know enough about the definitions of modernism to know if I could call myself a modernist. But yeah, I think that's definitely the writing that has inspired me a lot. Yeah.
So what else do you love? If you just think about the books that you feel have shaped you, not necessarily as a writer, but as a person, you know, those touchstone novels, what else would you add to that list?
Oh, I mean, Oscar Wilde, De Profundis, I think is my favourite work of his, and that is something that I read whenever I'm going through emotional anguish.
Can you describe it for us?
Yeah, so he wrote, it's a 60,000-word letter that he wrote to his ex-boyfriend from jail. And what I find most interesting about it is his work before that is like so, you know, he was all about aestheticism and art for art's sake, as he said. And I feel like one thing that his work was like often lacking was a kind of morality. It was so beautiful and it was so witty, but I think it wasn't till you get to, he was still, you know, a very privileged man in many ways, and I think it wasn't till he went to jail and was no longer in this privileged position, and like he had a complete reversal of circumstances, that he started thinking about like wider political issues. And so I think there's an emotional depth in De Profundis that you don't get in his earlier works, and I think that combined with his like incredible writing ability just makes it really special.
So what else has to sit there beside Oscar Wilde?
Then, to be honest, I would probably go into the comic and graphic novel world. Like, I'm really quite influenced by them. So, like, Persepolis, and I've forgotten the author's name, or Mouse by Art Spiegelman, I think, or Fun Home by Alison Bechdel, or actually something that has really influenced me also is Lost Girls by Alan Moore and Melinda Gebbie. And Alan Moore is the one who also wrote Viva Vendetta. I feel like people know him better for that. And Lost Girls is this graphic novel about Alice from Alice in Wonderland, Wendy from Peter Pan, and Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz, but their stories are retold as stories of sexual discovery. So like the tornado is like Dorothy's first orgasm. They are such pure examples of like children of virginity, you know, like we kind of like uphold them as like sacred stories. And so by making these stories like adult and sexual, and you know, it has like very graphic images in it, he was like really challenging our concept of sexuality versus like not being sexual. And I think also what he was trying to do in that, I've read interviews with him, and he speaks about how he was trying to show that like art and porn can coexist, and just because something like turns you on doesn't mean that it is suddenly like low culture and doesn't have like artistic merit. And so like that is a view that has like really influenced a lot of my work too. I like things to be erotic, and I think they can be erotic and beautifully written.
Which other writers do you think write erotica and sex well?
Oh, actually, who wrote Our Lady of the Flowers? John Genet. I've always really liked the way he wrote about sex, because I think he does a really good job of showing the body as something that's like kind of gross and disgusting, but also is something that you engage with other people and can be a really wonderful thing. I've never wanted to glamorize or romanticize sex. Like, I think a lot of the times sex is pretty absurd, because I think our bodies are absurd and I think life is generally quite absurd. So I've always liked the way he's written about sex. Yeah.
Now, in some ways, your novel is a bit of a classic Bildungsroman. I mean, there's the move from the country to the city. So are there other books that explore that shift that you can think of?
Oh, I mean, definitely I was obsessed with Melina Marchetta growing up. So many of her books fit into that. And I think also so many queer novels I've really liked also fit into that genre too. Nancy Garden, Annie on My Mind. I mean, that's not particularly incredibly written, but it's like an important queer text because it had a happy ending for lesbians, which was unusual at the time. And I read a lot of YA still. Like, it's probably one of my favourite genres.
Well, there's so much great YA writing. So what have you loved, and what do you still love that you've been reading?
Oh, I mean, Yeah, Melina Machado, obviously. Oh, and then actually, what's her name? Moriarty.
Jacqueline?
Yes, her books. Like the Finding Cassie Crazy books and things like that. That whole series was really excellent and formative. I think also I've been really influenced by a lot of Victorian era children's novels, like Princess and the Goblin, and also The Heir of Redcliffe by Charlotte M. Yonge. Like, I think I've really liked the kind of almost idealised morality of, like, Victorian-era novels.
So you're not about to be pigeonholed in your reading interests, which is just fantastic. So, Tilly, what have you read recently that you have just loved or been impressed by?
So I read recently, as in last week, I read A Scarlet Pansy by Robert Scully, which is a 1934 novel about a trans woman in New York. And I was obsessed with that. Like, I couldn't believe I hadn't read it earlier, just because it was so interesting to me that a lot of the queer lingo used in it in 1934 is like lingo that you see in the queer community today, like slay and fish. Like, I was just like, this is amazing. And it had like a real, it very much like captured the sort of like camp banter that exists in the queer community that was really, really nice to see. I read The Twyborn Affair by Patrick White. I thought that was incredible. I'd tried and failed to read Patrick White before. And in reading that, I finally got why he's so famous. Really, really love that. And that also was very much about a protagonist where the gender switches throughout. And so I really like the sort of ambiguity of that.
Tilly Lawless, congratulations on Nothing But My Body, and thank you so much for speaking to us on The Bookshelf.
Oh, my pleasure. That was fun.
It was fun, wasn't it, to hear such a collection of books and reading sitting adjacent to this debut novel. Tilly Lawless's Nothing But My Body is published by Allen and Unwin. English writer John McGregor has written 5 novels and 2 collections of short stories. If Nobody Speaks, Reservoir 13, Even the Dogs. If you haven't read any of his work, well, you should. His latest is Lean, Fall, Stand. 3 words that indicate 3 parts of a surprising whole. Lean, Fall, Stand. John McGregor, thank you so much for speaking to us on The Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
Now, congratulations on your novel, Lean, Fall, Stand. It begins in a dramatic landscape with a sudden storm that brings a young man, Thomas, to his knees. Where are we?
We're in Antarctica, which is a place I was lucky enough to almost go to about 17 years ago and to very slowly write about.
Almost go to?
Yeah, I was on a writing fellowship with the British Antarctic Survey, and we travelled down on their research ship to the main British base on the Antarctic Peninsula, and we never actually made it because the sea ice was too thick that year, and we spent about a week trying to break through the ice and eventually had to give up and turn around. So I had this amazing experience that was also wrapped up in this kind of failure and disappointment, which, you know, is thematically is fantastic in terms of thinking and reading and writing about Antarctica, but was also a very strange experience to process.
And so in this first third of your book, we're with 3 men, Thomas, Luke and Doc, 2 younger, 1 older. And at first I thought that's what you were writing, a book about a closed community. But what was that world like then for these 3?
So that was one of the things I was really interested in. The time I spent there with people who work in Antarctica and, you know, spend a lot of time in often very small teams in very isolated settings, there's clearly something really interesting, and the kind of the dynamic of that really struck me. And when you read back, you know, early accounts of Antarctic exploration, these groups of, you know, historically men kind of put together in very close quarters, very difficult situations, usually without the kind of social skills to deal with that adequately. Yeah, I just found that really striking. And the situation with the three characters in the book, the older guy who's Doc, who's been going there for 30 odd years, he's a technical guide. So he's very, very experienced at the logistics and the organization. And the two younger colleagues are the scientists, and they're the reason that they're there, and that, you know, they're doing the work that counts. And so the power relationship is really odd and skewed. And, you know, Doc keeps trying to act as if he's in charge, and he's not really in charge. And the two younger men are quite scared, really, and kind of acquiesce to his knowledge and his experience, but also find him annoying. And, you know, three people in that kind of triangle dynamic is always quite interesting in terms of human relationships, I think.
Yes, because it feels, at the beginning of the book, it feels as though our perspective is all coming from these two young, clever, I mean, even charming young men. And then you shift things for us. But the book opens with a storm that sort of blows their world apart. I mean, what does it do? I mean, does it bring the relationships into relief in some way?
I mean, I wanted to open with a storm. I spent a long time trying to write this book in a very kind of quiet, slow, detached kind of voice. And it was, I was telling it in hindsight, and it was all very reflective. And it kind of eventually dawned on me that I've got this kind of potentially exciting, dramatic landscape and situation and the crisis of and the danger and the risk. And that therefore it made sense for it to be much more dramatic and frightening. And the storm, you know, I read about these, they call them katabatic storms, where the winds come out of nowhere, just suddenly down the glacier, down the mountain, you know, storms of 100 miles an hour and just incredibly sudden changes in the situation. And, you know, as soon as you put three people who have maybe been having slightly tense, slightly grumpy interactions, you put them into a real crisis, then things happen, you know, things change. And what I was trying to kind of show was the way that, because they hadn't really resolved their relationship with each other, and they hadn't resolved their lines of communication and the ways that they would be clear with each other in the crisis, that lack of clarity, that lack of communication becomes really dangerous. So Doc isn't quite doing the things he needs to do, and Luke is too nervous to ask him, and you know, Thomas is downplaying the danger that he's in. And it all kind of comes back to their failure to have established open communication with each other.
And your novel begins in this really clear, cold language, which is spare and sharp. And then it changes dramatically because something has happened, and you have to render communication and thought and interior lives very differently. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it depends how much of a spoiler you're happy to include, but
maybe not too.
I'll go ahead.
Because I'd love you to talk about the sort of the poetry and the complexity of that language, but without giving away the whole trajectory of the novel.
Okay. So while they're in the crisis of this storm, Doc is injured, and he's injured in a way that affects his language and his ability to process and to express language. And that was something that I had become very interested in, partly because I'd been struggling to write about Antarctica and had been hung up on this issue of language and the kind of the limitations of language, the inadequacies of language in certain contexts. And that thought process had led me to learn about aphasia, which is a general term for a range of ways in which people's language can be limited or absent completely. And that usually follows, you know, brain injuries or strokes. And learning about aphasia almost joined the dots for me, and I wanted to take the fact that I had struggled to write about Antarctica and kind of move that into writing about people struggling with language and with losing their language. And so at the height of this storm, at the height of the kind of the danger that the three of them are in, Doc loses or begins to lose his language. His language kind of breaks down. And that was a lot of fun to write, to be honest with you. It was, you know, kind of trying to do that in a relatively subtle way initially, and to kind of build up the pace of it, and to have Doc not quite being aware of what was happening, and people around him to not understand why his words were beginning to jumble and you know, break down. I've always played with language, you know, that's how I've approached writing. Language comes before narrative for me. And so kind of playing with that, with ways of representing that on the page, was a lot of fun.
So I'd really like to ask you about other books that you might sit next to this novel of yours, Lean, Fall, Stand. Where would you start? What springs to mind?
On the bookshelf that was nearby while I was writing this book, there were a lot of, you know, research books and ideas books. And, you know, so I read a lot of the Antarctic literature, the classics, you know, the Jerry Apsley Garrard, Worst Journey in the World. It was a book by a guy called Richard Bird called Alive, which was written in the 20s or 30s, and about him being on his own and nearly dying. You know, all these books are about men on their own nearly dying. And, you know, a lot of that reading kind of interested me, and it's kind of inspiring, but also it's kind of, I was reading that almost to kind of capture the mood that would have inspired Doc, and, mm-hmm. and it's the kind of the atmosphere that Doc is nostalgic for. And it was really interesting. A lot of that early Antarctic literature tries at great length to physically describe the landscape and doesn't really manage, and just takes an incredibly long time to do it. But that was all part of the picture. Another Antarctic book, much, much more contemporary, by Jenny Diski, called Skating to Antarctica, about her going on a cruise to Antarctica, and really captured for me a lot of the kind of the silliness of the classic explorer adventurer view of Antarctica. But then a lot of the reading that I was doing and still do, just around language and fascination with language, and poets like Alice Oswald, Thomas A. Clarke, really kind of continue to inspire in me ambitions for what you can do with language. A work I've just come onto really recently, because I didn't know about it while I was writing, was there's a late piece by Samuel Beckett called What is the Word? And it turns out he had a brain injury quite late in his life and published a piece which is clearly written under the influence of aphasia. And yet nobody really noticed, because Samuel Beckett's work is so kind of fractured and dislocated anyway. So yeah, I'm really interested in exploring that.
John McGregor's Lean, Fall, Stand is published by Fourth Estate. And yes, he really does do surprising, intoxicating things with language. I'm Kate Evans from Radio National's weekly bookshelf program, where every week, with Cassie McCullough, we read new works of fiction. But in this special summer slot, writers talk about the bookshelf that shaped them. Make sure you follow The Bookshelf on the ABC Listen app or on your podcast catcher of choice for more writers and an awful lot of reading recommendations. Next week, Jennifer Mills and her ghosts and the essays of Siri Hustvedt.
What books are for, I think, are ways of entering the intimacy of other lives and being altered by them.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.